And again, I was putting this together and finding a study, and then I found a video that has everything that I would like to say. So part of what we're going to see, because the video gives that graphic, you know, image that is very interesting and intersects with archaeology as well. So we're going to, part of it, we're going to look. All right, but we're going to start with the context here, then we're going to move to the video, okay? So Jesus prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem. One of the most interesting texts is when he is carrying the cross towards the Calvary, Luke chapter 23. Some women are weeping because of him, and he tells to the women who are weeping for him, he says, "The days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the womb that has never bore and the breasts that have never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" So Jesus was announcing to that women that were weeping for him that there will be a time that they will be weeping much more. And the woman that was barren would consider that a blessing because she didn't have children that would suffer such a tragedy as in the times when judgment would come upon the people of God, and especially Jerusalem, and especially the temple. So there are like three judgments here. There's the judgment upon God's people. There is the judgment upon Jerusalem as a city. And there is not a judgment, but there is the element of the destruction of the temple, right? Which is very meaningful, which happened in the year 70. How did it happen? You could say, by the hand of God. Yeah, but historically, how did it happen? So, it happened because of the first Jewish revolt. As we've studied here, the Romans controlled the land, and the Jews paid taxes to the Romans. They were never comfortable with that. They never liked that. There were two sects among the Jews that fought the Romans. That was the Iscariotes. Like, Judah was Iscariot, we say, but the Iscariotes, they were a sect, radical sect that defended getting arms. The other sect was called the Sicarii. The Sicarii were another sect that were together, and they worked like the work of militia. They would attack Roman garrison here and retreat to the mountains, and they were doing that all the time, even in Jesus' time. And the Romans were coming and persecuting. It is believed that Barabbas was a Sicarii, that he was a guy that did, which would be called today a terrorist. But this was the minority of the people. But however, in 66, it spreads to the majority of the people. What happened? What happened is this. Some Jewish synagogue in Caesarea was desecrated by pagan sacrifice in front of it. There was an uprising in Caesarea. The Romans came and just killed a bunch of people, you know, they were really rough on them. This created, stirred up the spirit of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem. They started making all that they could against the Romans in Jerusalem. The Roman governor was not political. He was not like Pilate. He didn't administer well. He pressed on them. He took liberties, he put heavy taxes upon them, and when they couldn't pay the heavy taxes, he got a Roman garrison, invaded the temple, and sacked the temple and the money. And that was the last straw that broke the camel's back. So around the fall of the year 66, before Christ, so Jesus died on what we think year 33, okay? So year 66 it happened. So riots throughout Jerusalem that led even to the Roman garrison in Jerusalem to be expelled from the city. Soldiers were killed, and some were killed, and the garrison had to retrieve, right? So the emperor is Nero, and Nero takes a whole legion, which is 6,000 men. It's like a small army. It's an army, 4,000 to 6,000 men. In this case, every legion had like a number and like a name. So this is Legion 12 Fulminata, and their symbol is that one. Fulminata means like they fulminate, right? That's what they are. And he takes Legion 12 Fulminata and sends to Judea to quell to quell this revolt and the riot. What happens is that the Jews, they organized themselves and they said, enough is enough. So the around 6,000 Roman soldiers face a few tens of thousands of Jews. And what happens is that they are, instead of fulminating the Jews, they are fulminated. That legion is completely killed, entirely killed. Their standard, which is the flag, is taken away and disappear. That legion is. That is the Battle of Ben-Horon, which gives the beginning of it. That was the closest legion there, meaning that the Jews now were free. There were no more Romans. So they quickly establish a certain structure, a government. They expand the land. They put governors. They reinforce the walls of the cities and all. So they organize themselves. And that's how it started. The Romans, of course, they declared then war on the Jews. And the first thing that the Jews do is what? Away with the Roman currency. So they start printing their own money. And part of the printing of their own money, it's interesting, as you see in that top one, and this bottom one here too, is that they get the Roman coins, they hammer it, and they print their own money on top of it that is on metal. So they get the Roman coin, they kind of flatten it, and then they press, they mint their own. And it says, Jerusalem holy, one of them. The other says, free Jerusalem as well, which is not the one that is here, but there's the... So they mark the year. So they mark year one of our independence, year two. So each coin is marked, and it's very significant. They don't put people in their coins, right? The Jews don't, because of the Second Commandment. They put symbols. So they would use the menorah, they use pomegranates, they use a cup, the holy cup, the holy bread, wheat, symbols of God. That's what they would use. So what happened then is that Emperor Nero sends a guy called Vespasian to quash. So in 67, he gives him four legions. So he puts him in charge of four legions. So over 20, around what would be 20,000 soldiers, well-trained, well-equipped, that were now ready for war, ready for siege, for how many time, with the whole Roman Empire behind them. Because at that point, that was the biggest war region. There was no war in the empire anywhere. The armies were pretty much sitting idle. So he gets the best men, the best guys, and puts them there. And he starts then from the northern part of the Palestine. And can you show to us, please? So you see all parts in from dark to clear blue is what was controlled by the Jews. And the clear blue is what they lost first. Then the darker blue is what they lost second. Then they kept only at... So they lost Galilee first in this part. Then they lost Judea, and they kept this part here first. which was the last. So as the campaign came forward, the campaign started in Galilee. And Vespasian is vicious. He doesn't care. So we have a little bit of his campaign. So he invades, here's Galilee, see here, Nazareth, okay? Here is here, and here would be Bethsaida or Julius. Bethsaida, I talked about Sunday. So here is here. So he goes through the main towns and he destroys, and this is him. He would become an emperor later. And what happens is that in charge of the northern Jewish garrison was a man called Flavius Josephus. This guy, he loses the battle. He's taken as a prisoner and used as an interpreter. This is a later picture of him. So, and this is Yodfat, the battle that happened here. The Romans conquered the city. They take him prisoner, and they need him as an interpreter. So he becomes because he speaks very good Greek, he's versed, he speaks many languages, and he speaks Hebrew. And from this guy that is the interpreter, and he's interpreted directly to Vespasian, he becomes friends with Vespasian. After the war, he's set free by Vespasian and is given Roman citizenship. And he embraces full Roman. He becomes fully Roman. And later in his life, it seems that he has a little Jewish conversion again, and he writes more about the Jews. But he wrote to us this book, which is called The War of the Jews. And it's the account that we have about this war. And that's how we know so much. We know details about this war because he told us about this war and how it progressed and how it went. As it was a war, and a war is made mostly of destruction, we don't have a lot of archaeology about it, but Josephus gives us detail. We have, however, a milestone that marks the destruction of the roads. One of the things that the Romans did was their tactic is destroyed their own roads. So the armies of the enemy wouldn't be able to travel upon them or make quick traveling or speed. So they destroyed the whole roads. They circled cities. They made siege on cities. They cut the supplies. The Romans were just magnificent warriors. They had everything in terms of logistics and battle, and they knew how to do it. And when a few years later, like actually more than half a century later, they were written, so this hallmark is interesting. Because it says, here Emperor Hadrian is rebuilding the roads that were destroyed when the Jewish revolt. So this is an interesting hallmark. But soon, look, Vespasian didn't take a lot of time. He soon makes progress, and he is soon at the gates of Jerusalem. Where were the biggest Jewish army? The most fortified city, the stronghold of the Jews, where they were. So Jerusalem. And for the Jews, it's not a problem to lose part of the territory because Jerusalem is the city of God. And everything that goes in Jerusalem is what defines. So this doesn't matter to lose the territory. But it's from Jerusalem or it's on Jerusalem. There is the battle. It's estimated that when Vespasian gets to Jerusalem, there is more than a half a million Jews inside the city. What happens is that Nero dies, the emperor. He doesn't die. He's kind of killed but dies because he's a madman, and he asks his armor bearer to kill him, and we don't know. It's a funny story, but he dies, right? And that's perhaps a good thing. I mean, I don't think anyone cried his death. Then Vespasian hears that Nero died. And because he's the strong man, and Nero doesn't have sons necessarily to put in place, he returns to Rome to claim the title of emperor. And he gets it. Vespasian gets it. He leaves in charge his son, Titus. And that's what we're going to see here. The video that we're going to see is the siege and the battle of Jerusalem. So he leaves his son, that is promoted to general, Titus, to conquer the city of Jerusalem. Okay? And that is around the year 68 A.D. So 2 years after the revolt started, Titus is at the gates of Jerusalem.
In the spring of the years, CE. Titus marches his legions from the coastal plain to Jerusalem. He's boiling with anger. It has been 4 years and the Roman army has not succeeded in suppressing the stubborn revolt that broke out in Judea. The Jews fight courageously for every piece of land. Even the esteemed commander Vespasian, Titus' father, could not defeat them. Now, after his father's appointment to emperor, it's Titus' turn to manage the campaign. He commands the most powerful war machine in the world, tens of thousands of trained legionnaires, equipped with advanced weapons, sophisticated breaching tools, and lethal artillery. Against the mighty Roman army stands a small force of fighters who will fight for their freedom until their last drop of blood. The final battle of the great revolt against Rome begins. It will be a battle that will never be forgotten.
Got a large mushroom pizza.
Susan Marie, pizza again.
Captain Palmer, hello.
In the dark of night, Titus brings up his soldiers from three directions to Jerusalem. As dawn breaks on the 14th of Nisan, the eve of Passover, the residents of Jerusalem awaken to a sight that makes their blood run cold. 60,000 Roman soldiers, thirsty for war, surround the city from every direction. Only now, when the Romans stand at the gates of the city, does the tragedy caused by the civil war raging in the city become clear. In clashes between the various factions, whole sections of Jerusalem were destroyed. Stores of food that could have provided vital provisions during the fighting and siege went up in flames and vanished. Too late, the rebels joined forces against the true enemy. What they lack in weaponry and soldiers will be reinforced by acts of bravery and unrestrained daring. The Jews take the initiative and respond quickly. They attack ferociously before the Romans take up positions. The surprised Romans scatter in all directions. Titus himself escapes by the skin of his teeth. Before the Romans manage to recover, the Jews retreat behind the mighty defenses of the walls of Jerusalem. These walls are Titus' main problem. Jerusalem is built on a hill and surrounded by three fortified walls, each stronger than the other. To breach such a wall, Titus must raise huge earthen ramps and bring up siege towers and battering rams to breach it. In excavations conducted in Jerusalem, in the Russian compound, remains of the third wall have been found. It is the outer wall of the ancient city. We have here testimony to the battle. We found more than 70 catapult stones right here at the front of the wall. So that we know, a battle took place here. The number and density of the catapult stones and their locations are basically the testimony that there was a battle here during the Roman period, dated according to the potsherds. The evidence enabled us to conclude that we are dealing with a section of the third wall through which the Romans penetrated Jerusalem. With these huge catapult stones, Titus' soldiers bombarded the Jewish defenders, thus ensuring that they would not disturb the builds of the ramping. Each of these stones weighs about 26 kilograms and flew at a speed of tens of kilometers per hour. When a stone like this crashed into the wall, it was better not to be there. Under heavy artillery cover, the iron rams climbed to the top of the wall and pierced it. The noise is deafening. The largest battering ram of all, nicknamed Nikon, the Victor, was the first to breach the wall. The Roman soldiers burst into Bethsaida neighborhood. They slaughtered the residents without mercy and set the entire neighborhood on fire. Within a few days, the second wall also falls. The Jewish defenses begin to disintegrate. Titus renews the attack and advances his soldiers to the internal wall, the strongest wall of Jerusalem, known as the First Wall. He concentrates most of his efforts here at the Antonia Fortress. The Antonia is the largest, strongest fortress in Jerusalem. It was built by Herod to the north of the Temple Mount in order to control the temple. Titus' plan was well thought out. The moment the Antonia falls, the temple will fall. And when the temple falls, the Jews will lose all hope and Jerusalem will finally fall into his hands. But nothing prepared him for what happens next. In a daring action, the soldiers of John of Giscala succeed in digging a tunnel under the earthen ramp opposite the Antonia, setting fire to its foundations and toppling it together with the soldiers to the ground. At the same time, Simon Bar Giora attacks the ramp opposite the first wall and sets it on fire. Hundreds of Roman soldiers are killed and wounded. All at once, the Roman attack is halted and the entire Roman army is driven out of the city. Stunned by the failure, Titus gathers his commanders urgently and decides to change tactics. If it is not possible to break into the city, he will surround it from without and starve the Jews to death. In a record time of only 3 days, Titus builds a giant siege wall around Jerusalem, a choke ring 7 kilometers long that effectively blocks off all supply lines. Now, starvation sets in to cruelly afflict the city. Affluent people scour the gutters to find scraps of food, and small children whose parents have starved to death wander the streets in search of a piece of bread. The tension in the city grows. Those who are left with a little food eat in secret. Others try to evade the zealots and escape from the city. Most of those who try to flee are caught by the Romans and crucified on wooden beams around the city walls. Fatigue and starvation weaken the Jewish fighters. This is Titus' chance to deal the crushing blow to Jerusalem. The Roman army is concentrated on one task: to conquer Antonia Fortress and break through to the temple. The Jews tried to prevent the capture of the Temple Mount and sabotage the building of the ramps. They shot flaming arrows, threw giant stones, and poured boiling oil on the head of the Roman soldiers. In the Temple Mount sifting project, iron arrowheads were found. These arrowheads were used for catapult fire. Catapults are machines for shooting arrows, and they bombarded the walls with such force that even the bravest of the Jewish fighters could not withstand. After fierce battles, Titus soldiers gained control of the Antonia. On the 17th of Tammuz, Titus commands them to destroy the mighty citadel down to its foundations. This day, on which, according to tradition, the city was breached, is commemorated as a day of mourning on the Jewish calendar. The temple service ceased completely, and during the following 3 weeks, the days between the straits, the Jews would struggle in bloody face-to-face battles in the courtyards of God's temple. The battering rams breached the western walls of the Temple Mount. Ladders are leaned against the remains of the wall, and the Roman soldiers stream in mass into the temple courtyard. It seems that the campaign is drawing to a close, but what happens next is totally inconceivable. When the Jews realize that the temple is in real danger, they shake off all feelings of hunger and weakness. Thousands of citizens, women, men, elders, and youth, everyone who can hold a weapon, join the fighters. Together, as one man, they fall upon the Romans and block the way to the temple with their bodies. Only one weapon can beat the fire of faith that burns in the hearts of the Jewish fighters, the burning fire of torches. And thus, on the night of the 9th of Av, Titus sets fire to the gates that surround the Temple Mount. On their way to the temple, the Romans burst through, killing, stabbing, and trampling everyone in their path. The blood flows on the colorful stone floors of the Temple Mount as bodies of the slain pile high. The flames quickly spread and approach the entrance to the temple. A moment before it goes up in flames, Titus gathers his commanders for a final consultation to determine the fate of the temple. Josephus claims that Titus opposed destroying the temple, which in his eyes was the glory of human creation. According to Josephus, the fire was caused by accident by a Roman soldier who inadvertently tossed a burning torch into the sanctuary. But most scholars do not believe this is really true. The anger over the many casualties caused by the Jews and the understanding that as long as the temple stood, the Jews would continue to fight, decided the temple's fate. Let them see and fear. On the 9th of Av, towards evening, Titus gave the order, and the following day, the 10th of Av, his soldiers set fire to the sanctuary. The temple that had been the source of inspiration, faith, ethics and righteousness for the Jewish people and all humanity for centuries now went up in flames. The cries of pain of the Jews rose up to the heavens. Titus commands the burning of the lower city. In the upper city, the rebels continue to fight stubbornly for another month until the Romans take control of it too and set it ablaze. The charred remains of fire and destruction discovered by Professor Nachman of God in what was once an opulent neighborhood tell the story of the complete destruction of Jerusalem. Chilling testimony to the last moments of the city is found here between layers of ruins and ashes. The severed arm of a young woman with a spear alongside it. It appears that she too was unable to escape to the rebels' final refuge, the underground drainage channel. We're inside the drainage channel where the rebels hid 2,000 years ago. The last of the Jerusalem residents hid in this tunnel, here, where we stand. Suffocating darkness and terrible fear surrounded them. The Romans searched for them, found them, broke through the ceiling of the tunnel, and killed everyone. Among the finds discovered here that testify to the horror was this Roman sword, the Roman gladius, found on the tunnel floor. Nearby were cooking pots, clay lamps, and coins of the revolt, with the Hebrew words, Herut Zion, freedom for Zion, two words that expressed the heartfelt aspiration of the Jews who hid and were killed here in the drainage channel in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. It is possible that the death of these people in the depths of the ground was preferable to the horrors suffered by their brethren who were taken captive. The prisoners were sold into lifelong slavery or died in blood sport, fighting against wild animals and gladiators. In pain, shock, and sorrow, the Jewish prisoners are marched through the streets of Rome. And before them go the spoils of war from Jerusalem, the golden menorah, and the holy vessels of the temple. Rome celebrates its victory with a parade, with huge monuments and a special coin that glorifies and commemorates the suppression of Judea. Jerusalem, weeping and mourning, descends under layers of ash and destruction. After 5 years of persistent struggle against the strongest empire in the world, the Second Temple is destroyed.
Presentation like that gives like a real feeling of the carnage that it was and how much the Jews were able to resist. So moving along, Titus Caesar Vespasianus is because he later became emperor himself. So when his father dies 10 years later, Titus, the one who destroyed Jerusalem, becomes an emperor as well. The legion that was associated with the destruction of Jerusalem, which Titus was in charge of, although, as you saw, that the final battle, there were like around 10 legions there, but it's the legion 10, Fretensis, and they left their marks in Jerusalem many times. So there are many places in which you find the inscription of this legion, because this legion is the one that stayed camped in Jerusalem for almost like half a century to keep the Jews out of it. We talked about the catapults of the Romans. Here's a replica of what would be, and the stones that they threw, which could get the next one. We could get to 50 pounds. Some of the stones would be up to 50 pounds as they threw. Also, we talked about the burn house. Burn house has come up. It lived to be the house of the family of Caiaphas. We talked before. And see, it's very clear, like the burning of it. There's another image, like the you see like how it's burned the walls. And in this place, they found that severed arm holding like a spear or a spear on the side, someone that had been killed and destroyed. The victory of Titus is celebrated with the building of a triumphal arch, which is in Rome. So it's in the city of Rome. It's called the Arch of Titus. It was done by Titus' brother, who also became emperor after him, to celebrate. And what is most amazing about this arch is the images, especially one in particular. So it's full of art, is very beautiful. This is Titus in his horse and being drawn, getting in glory. This image is the amazing, because here you have the items of the temple items, the utensils of the temple, which are represented. And it's the only place in the whole earth that the temple utensils are drawn or represented in real, with a real perspective, which is very interesting, and it gives us an idea of the size of the menorah and other things. These items here, they are believed to have been brought to the Temple of Pax, which is a temple that was built by Vespasian, which are these ruins, and they are believed to have remained in that temple until they were later removed. And some believe that they were brought up to Jerusalem. So there's a lot of stories of where the items are. They're hidden somewhere. There are stories that the Crusaders found later, like the knights, the Templar knights found these items and are keeping them in secret. So there's a whole story of where the temple items are. We talked about he talked about also the coin, the Judea Capta, which is the Roman coins that was celebrated here with the victory of Vespasian. And actually, the revolt of the Jews went on until the year 73. So the last people gathered here in this mountain fortress, which was built by Herod the Great, and they stayed there until 73. When finally in 73, the Romans were building a road on this hill here, they were building a road on the side. They were like amazing builders as much as fighters. They were building a road on the side to reach to them. There were 967 people and 960 committed suicide. There were only remained seven to tell the story. There was women and children. They didn't want to let be captured or taken to Rome or given to the lions, whatever. I mean, they prefer that, and that's how it happened. What was the consequence? So here we get to an interesting part. So first, the Jews, this is another coin that celebrated, was coined later here as well, that is to celebrate Titus. So the one coin was to celebrate Vespasian, this is to celebrate Titus, another coin to celebrate. The Romans really made a big deal out of this. During that whole, that half century there, it was their biggest victory, it was the biggest thing. It was, I mean, they talked about it, they celebrated, they built monuments. There are two arches of Titus, actually. One of them is pretty destroyed, we don't have much, but that remained, and they really made a big deal out of this, and it was a huge war. If they had to move 60,000 soldiers, it's because it was a major, major conflict for them. So consequences. The Jews lost control of the Holy Land, which without them faced economic decline. Since the year 70, they had never had any role of leadership. Remember the kind of transaction that happened between the Jewish leadership and Pilate to kill Jesus, right? Because the Jewish leadership had some saying. And the Roman governors worked with the Jewish leadership to kind of control their own people, and they let them do their thing. After the year 70, the Jews were, I mean, they were openly persecuted in society, and they were not respected by the Romans at all. They were considered the worst kind, like barbaric people. And so from the year 70, they never held the control of the land anymore, and the land started to face economic decline because there were no more Jews, no more business, no more things going on there. Second thing is there was a collapse of the Jewish oligarchy and the centralized leadership. Also, all the leaders died, so there was no more Jewish leadership. That's when the Jewish community started to be spread, like the big diaspora, all over the world. Where they were, small synagogues. Synagogues became the center of their worship. The temple was destroyed, so all the utensils disappeared. We saw that they were taken to the Temple of Pax, but we don't know what happened to them later. And the synagogues then now become the main center of, and they have been for 2,000 years, because since the year 70, the temple have been destroyed, was never rebuilt. The Jews were banned from the grounds of Jerusalem, except one day a year. Which year was that? The year that the Romans celebrated their defeat. That was the year that they could come into Jerusalem. The Romans did that on purpose. What happened is that two wars ended up happening after that. So around 60 years after that war, the Jews gathered together and made one first effort between 115 and 117 It was called the Quito's War because it was a man called Quito's who led it. But it was a small number of Jews, and that's considered like the second Jewish revolt, but it didn't do much. Possibly the second Jewish revolt led to a third Jewish revolt. And this third Jewish revolt happened between 132 and 136, and it was led by a man called Bar Koba, or Shimon Bar Koba. And this was as big as the first one, as big as the first one. So this guy was considered a Messiah. This Shimon Bar Koba was considered a Messiah. So he unifies the Jewish people. They come to the land. They kick the Romans out. They get control of Judea. They establish a government. They couldn't rebuild the temple, but they establish a government there. And they hold out for 4 years. What do they start doing? Minting coins. So we have coins that they minted. So these coins, you see here that this is the print, and it was a Roman coin that, again, they kind of hammered it flat and then print their own coins. And it says, freedom to Jerusalem. Freedom to Jerusalem. So, Hagia Zion, the same thing that we said there. And they mark like year one, year two, year three, year four. But what happened is that eventually they lose the war again, and they are quashed. So what happens? After this third war, the Jews are prohibited to live in Judea. They are prohibited to have Jews there. They cannot live there. The Romans get to the conclusion, you cannot live there. In fact, they change the name of the region. From Judea, what is the name that they give the name to? Palestina. After the arch enemy of the Jews in the time of King David, the Philistines. The Romans do that to be like in their nose. We're going to name this your arch enemies, Philistines. This is Philistia. So they call it Syria Philistina. And that's why it has the name Palestine today, because that's the name that the Romans gave after this third Jewish war in the year 136, because they wanted to be like a provocation and humiliation to the Jews. It's not Judea. It's not the land of Jews. It is the land of the Philistines, Syria Philistina. And they changed the name of the city. The city is not more Jerusalem. It is Aelia Capitolina. So Capitolina is a hill. Capitolio is a hill. It's one of the hills around Rome. It's actually a sacred hill. And Aelia is the royal family name of Emperor Hadrian. So the city is called like the hill of the Hadrian family. It's a hill that is named after the emperor. And it remains Aelia Capitolina for 5 centuries. They mint a coin in celebration of that, which is this coin here that is minted by Emperor Hadrian, which is Colonia Aelia Capitolina Condita, meaning the foundation of the colony of Aelia Capitolina. They are what we're doing, what we say today, which is rewriting history, whitewashing history, what we call it narrative, right? Completely trying to say, this is not Jewish anymore. This is a new land. We're going to, and this is what came about. And this is what the Romans do with the city. So here is where the 10th Roman Legion is. Here's where the Temple Mount was. And here's where they built a city. So they built a city on the upper part, the northern part, as a Roman city is built there. And in the place of the temple, of the temple of the Lord, what did they do? They built the temple to Jupiter in that place. Again, to be like in your face, here is a temple of Jupiter. That's what it is done there. What happens is that 3 centuries later, or 2.5 centuries later, the Roman Empire becomes Christian. And then the whole city that was a pagan city, Aelia Capitolina, with the Jewish temple of Jupiter, is completely changed and transformed. The temple of Jupiter is turned into a temple, a Christian temple to the Lord. And a Byzantine reform is made. And we have 2 drawings of the city. I showed you this before. So this is like a map, mosaic of Jerusalem, of the year 560. And here you have the northern part, southern part, right? So east and west. Did I got it right this time? Okay, I got it. So on this part, you see there are temples. The same thing is like, here is the Holy Sepulcher. Here is the upper room. So you have this configuration. There is a Christian temple. Another mosaic that we have that I showed to you before also shows the Byzantine Jerusalem, the Christian Jerusalem of the 6th century, which is this. So you have here the temple there, the Holy Sepulcher, the upper room, and the first church, where it's considered to be have been the site of the first church, right? And this city then, after the year 70, after year 136, let's say, becomes Roman. 4th century becomes Jewish. And what happens to it? So this is a drawing, just going back a bit. This is 6th century, so 500 and something, okay? The previous one is, no, the one before, 560, 565. So what happened is that in the year 638, the Arabs invade and conquer the land. So it was Roman from 136 to around 320. 320 to 638 was Christian, Roman Christian, Byzantine. And from the year 638, it has been in control of the Muslims until the Six-Day War in 1968. So from 638 until 1968, it was controlled, it was run by Arabs and Muslims, Muslim Arabs. So what happens is that the caliph, the leader, he first builds a praying house where it was the Christian Byzantine temple. And there are, in some places of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was renewed 60 years ago, they found some tiles, which they covered, but some photos were taken. Byzantine tiles of what could have been a Byzantine Christian temple there, which was probably the temple that they built upon the temple of Jupiter, which was built upon the temple of the Lord. So you realize there's the temple of the Lord, the temple of Jupiter, a Christian basilica, Byzantine, and then they built a house for prayer for the Muslims. No, 600. 600, yes. I'm just going to check this because as my memory is flawed. Okay. The prophet lived from 570 to 632. So the prophet Muhammad lived from 570 to 632. So that was after the prophet. Thank you, because I could be wrong. I could have switched numbers there. But that, I think that number checks out. So 638, the Muslims go in the city. They take control. They built a house of prayer. In this house of prayer, as they are there for centuries and unchallenged, not by Christians, Christians start going back there in the 12th century, 11th century, the Crusades, 12th century. So that is, let's say, 500 years later, someone with an interest in the land goes there to claim it. So for 500 years, they lived in the land as if it was their own, not challenge anyone. So they start expanding. And finally, the configuration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that we have there, the size of it was built. It's the next. So this size here, this size with the gardens, and this configuration, here's the mosque, and here's the Dome of the Rock, was built in the 13th century. So in the 13th century, it was built. These buildings here, they are 13th century, but they were renewed, including this Golden Dome, was renewed earlier in the 20th century. It was renewed earlier in the 20th century. So pretty much it was not so nice. These gardens were all built earlier in the 20th century, like the plants and all. It was just all flat land over there. But this is the site that it was. So here's the mosque, and here's the Dome of the Rock. And under the Dome of the Rock, it is believed, it's just a building that hosts a rock, which is believed to be the rock that Abraham sacrificed or was about to sacrifice Isaac, the rock which was the first element in God's creation. God created that rock, and the world around it is the rock from which Prophet Muhammad was taken from heaven, so it's very holy. And this is a sacred place. The Crusaders, when they conquered the land and had a control for a while, they made this into a palace. They didn't turn into a sacred place. So they used it as a palace. So it was a palace for the king crusader for a while, for a few decades. It turns into a palace. Then a palace. Then eventually, Saladin conquers back the land, and he turns it back into a house of prayer. And then since that, it has never been challenged as so. It has been considered like a Muslim place and not challenged. The Jews pretty much didn't have interest in the land until the 1800s. Not that they didn't have interest in the land, but they didn't have any political inclination to go back to the land and occupy that land until the 1800s, when a certain philosophy called Zionism starts to grow in the Jewish community that desire to go back. And a lot of them go back in the 1900s. A good group goes back after First World War. The British promised the Jews they're going to give them the land if they win First World War, if they help them. But the British also offered the Arabs the same. So the British, it's called the double promise. It is very known historically. So the British says, because that land belonged to the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, and the Ottoman Turks sided with Germany. So the Brits send an army there and says, the Jews, if you help us to expel the Ottomans, the land will be yours. They go to the Arabs. Remember Lawrence of Arabia? Lawrence of Arabia is when it happens. Lawrence of Arabia works with the Arabs and says, If you help us expel the Turks, the land will be yours. So the British offered this. It's actually, this is traced to be the root of terrorism, and especially that hate of the Arabics against the Western, because when the war is done, they don't give control to neither of them, but give power to the Jews more than to the Arabics. Then what comes? The Second World War, then the establishment of the Jewish state in 48, then the war in 68, 69, and they get control. And gradually the Jews have gotten more and more control of the land, directly or indirectly. But that's how it has been. There's a lot that we could talk more, but the time is just going, and I don't want to talk more. It's like, will the temple ever be rebuilt? That's a good question, which would take a whole class here. And I would love to entertain some of you with what I think. But we're going to pray, and if you want to talk about it, we could. However, let's finish with this. Jesus' words have been fulfilled. No stone was left standing. It was destroyed. And if there's a promise of rebuilding of the temple, that is up for debate. So some see in Revelation a promise for the rebuilding of the temple. I don't see it. For instance, I'll tell you, I don't see any promise of rebuilding directly. I don't think it has any meaning. I'm not saying that it won't be rebuilt. Maybe the Jews will rebuild. But I'm saying there's no spiritual meaning in rebuilding. I don't see any promise in it. I don't interpret that way. I know that others do, and I respect that, and it's a prophecy for the future, so it's still open to our understanding. But the fact is that while the temple lies in ruins and the Jews are fighting for their land, God is telling them that is through Jesus Christ, whom they have rejected. God is telling them it's through Jesus Christ. God has indeed punished his people. And the fact that they don't have the land, the fact that they don't have the temple and they can worship him, is God telling them, I built a new temple through the body and blood of Jesus Christ. You should come to me. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can go to the Father if not, he says, he uses a preposition that is through me, that is by me, through me. No one, no Jew, no Gentile. And God is telling them, there is a new temple that was built. Remember the words of Jesus to the woman, the Samaritan woman? He says, oh woman, there's coming a time, and it is now, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. So it's not through a building. Not through the sacrifice of animals, but it's through the Holy Spirit and in truth that is Jesus Christ. And that's what the God is telling them. It's like, no, as you've rejected my Son, whom I sent, then you don't have the land, you don't have the temple. What will happen? We can discuss and talk and debate. Let's pray. Lord,